and welcome to Pro Mining Talk. I'm Jason Papier.
And I'm Peter Johnson.
And in this week's show, we will be interviewing Marv Tuttle and Jim Barnash of the Financial Planning Association.
Marv is the executive director of the FPA, and Jim Barnash is the current president. The FPA is probably the major industry organization in the U.S. for financial planners. It includes fee-only and commission-based planners. It's a very inclusive organization. Personally, I've been involved with it for quite a while. I'm the current chairman of the Silicon Valley chapter of the FPA with about 300 members here in Silicon Valley. And I've been impressed with the way the Financial Planning Association has been training leaders and looking at what is valuable to the consumer. So I think it's an organization that has consumers' interests at heart, which may not be true for all industry associations. And I think that comes out in the interview.
To see the show notes, please visit our website at www.promoneytalk.com. There you can sign up for our email list, and you can contact us and ask us questions.
And if you want to visit the FPA, the website is fpanet. That's fpanet.org.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show today. Today we're speaking to Marv Tuttle and Jim Barnash, Executive Director and President of the Financial Planning Association, respectively. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
To start us off, can you tell us, what is the Financial Planning Association? What role does it play?
Financial Planning Association is the membership community for financial planning. We serve individuals who deliver financial planning, support financial planning for the ultimate benefit of those who need financial planning. Currently, we have approximately 28,000 members in, I think the last count was, 43 countries throughout the world.
Yeah, the FPA is an organization that, although it was founded as a membership association, in its short 5 3/4 years existence, has moved well beyond that into an advocacy organization, fighting for the rights of consumers who use financial planning and financial services, as well as the members of FPA to protect their rights to make sure that there's a level playing field for the delivery of quality advice in the marketplace.
So the FPA is growing into more than just a membership organization. It's growing into an organization to support the general public as well.
Yes, I mean, the idea behind FPA was very deliberate in not calling it the Financial Planner Association, rather the Financial Planning Association. And that distinction really says that FPA is about more than just delivering membership benefits of continuing education, body of knowledge, conferences, things of that nature, but really to fight for the clear identity of financial planning as the umbrella for the other subsets, which would be the other types of advice, investment, insurance, etc., but also to work with the legislators and regulators to make sure that the rules that are in place today in this world have to deal with the issues and the way that people want to have advice and relationships for that advice versus the rules of 35 or 40 years ago.
Well, it is a very young profession, and we're all trying to make sense out of it. The certification standards, the education standards, the disclosure standards, and so on is really just evolving.
They are, and it's actually quite confusing, not only for the person who would need financial planning, but there are many people who are actually practicing in the financial services industry today that are confused. They may be coming into the financial services industry being told that the firm they're joining is delivering financial planning, only to find out that it's very product and transactional oriented, where those of us that have been around understand that financial planning is very much towards the relationship aspect, and it's advice driven, and that product follows the advice, not advice follows the product.
Well, you mentioned that the FPA has about 28,000 members in a number of countries, primarily in the United States. I know there are other financial planning groups around the world. Get some idea of the numbers. How many people are out there as brokers and as fee-only advisors? How big is the FPA in relation to the different groups that practice and give advice?
Well, I mean, we have 28,000 members, and I would characterize them as financial planners that work under different compensation models. 20% of our members would be classified as fee-only. Another 65% would be classified as those that would charge fees for advice and help the client with implementation. And then the remaining 15% are a variety of types, which would be primarily just commission-only planners or those that might be in a traditional financial services institution and get paid a salary for providing advice.
Okay. And I think our listeners know that Jason and I practice as fee-only advisors. I know the FPA is an inclusive body, and that means that it welcomes people from different backgrounds and different methods of compensation as long as the focus is primarily on the welfare of the client.
Peter, the important aspect here is to put the client's interest first and to have full disclosure about how you get compensated. The client then is an educated person who has an opportunity then to make a choice. And if they choose to want to go with a different model, then that model is out there and exists for them. But it also provides for a variety where people of different income levels can find quality financial planning advice that they can afford to pay for. So there may be instances where they don't have a lot of money. Perhaps an hourly service is better for them, or someone who's going to do a modest charge for it for the financial plan, but then would be compensated through either investment or insurance commissions, where that suits the need of that particular marketplace. So it really is not so much about the type of compensation that's delivered. It's making financial planning accessible to people at all income levels throughout the world.
You've talked about the different kinds of compensation that may work for different segments of the market. A question that we get a lot is, you know, should I see a financial planner? How much money do I need to have before I see a financial planner?
Well, I don't think money necessarily should be the issue. My personal opinion, and I think it's shared by the board of directors here at FPA, is that we believe everybody should have access to some means of financial planning. Now, that may vary from the affluent who have the ability to pay for the services of a firm such as yours and have a very advisory relationship to the middle class who may find that they need to have different type of relationship that might involve lower fees and or a combination of fees and commissions, to the indigent who we need to be able to provide pro bono services for as a profession. And it's never too early to start seeking the advice of a financial professional, a financial planner. I think that we need to do a better job in educating children that are in the primary schools and high schools, and then certainly into the college years, so that when our future supporters of our economy and our system of the world get into the marketplace, they have a better understanding of financial concepts. They already have a road plan, and that their lives will end up being better. They'll make less mistakes with money than perhaps we have as a generation.
So the FPA has been involved in some partnerships with national groups and also with some pro bono work, and I'll bet our listeners would be interested in hearing that.
Well, 9/11 caused us to think as an organization as far as our commitment, responsibility to serve society, and it was with 9/11 that we ramped up and started to ask our members to get involved in providing services to individuals who needed them the most at that time. 9/11, look at pro bono services in a different way than you might with Katrina. 9/11, we didn't really spend much time worrying about how much money a person made with that. It was just that they were in need of financial triage, some hand-holding in terms of just how do I get my life back together. And since 9/11 2001, I mean, we are still at it with families and victims of that event for 4 years, and we still have an office in New York City serving individuals that have suffered greatly as a result of 9/11. We've moved on and learned from that experience to say that the financial planning profession can provide a lot of goodwill and care to people that are most in need, whether it's wildfires in California or hurricanes. And right now we're very, very focused on Katrina in terms of how we can best serve the people of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas. And the other issue that we're facing here, we have to actually do pro bono work for our own members, who this is the first time in our history that we've seen significant loss business and people that are in our profession of financial planning that have lost their homes and suffered great damages. And so we're spending time trying to really get in touch with our members that have been displaced and see how we can help them. So better put is that we've got a two-pronged effort going on with Katrina, and we're just trying to work with our members throughout the country consistently to spread the message that we all have an obligation to serve society and to give back because of our efforts serving clients. We've been professionally rewarded, and it's important for us to give back to those that, as Jim says, deserve some kind of access to financial planning. I think pro bono services allow us the means to do that.
Financial life's complicated enough, but after a disaster, you're emotionally distraught, and there's a number of additional complexities that come into the picture. There's some special tax relief. There's insurance to deal with. What kinds of issues have people had in some of the disasters that the FPA has assisted with?
Well, I think you just identified a few, and one of the things that we've recently done is to create a website, a special website that's called FPAReliefCenter.org, that our members and hopefully the public can benefit from the information there that is tax-related, compliance-related. What are the kind of the special governmental acts that have occurred since 9/11 and Katrina that people can get more information on? And that website is going to serve as a place for that.
Well, that is fantastic. That would make a great show by itself. Well, another aspect is that we have chapters all over the country. We have, 102 chapters, I believe, throughout the U.S., and we've got one here in Silicon Valley with about, I think, 275 members or so. The chapters are a great way for aspiring financial planners to hook up and learn what the business is about and for existing members to get education, and we do support each other.
Jim, I want to ask you a question. You guys had mentioned about the pro bono work of the FPA, and we talked about the disaster and disaster recovery efforts. You'd also mentioned education. What efforts is the FPA doing to promote financial education in our schools?
Well, a lot of what we have done in the past is to try and work with other organizations like the National Endowment for Financial Education, NEFE, the CFP Board of Standards, organizations like that who have some programs that are out there. We believe that, as Peter alluded to, with our 102 chapters and our 28,000 members, that we have a delivery mechanism for a lot of these programs, that there's government money that's available, there's foundation money that's available, things of that nature. Recently, we have decided that we need to take a more proactive stance because of, unfortunately, in the world, especially when you're dealing with the federal government, there's so much red tape, blue tape, all kinds of tape, that it's hard to get systems and processes to actually get into delivery. So there are some movements, certainly especially in some chapters where we're doing some programs already where it's getting more involved in education at various levels. There's a great passion on the part of our membership to deliver education in the schools to youngsters, believing that the Jumpstart program, we're involved with the Jumpstart program and supporting that, and our members help to deliver that. But it's getting people aware of financial issues early in their life. Many of the minorities don't have the history of growing up at the dinner table talking about financial issues, and this is becoming extremely important that we don't end up with a society of the haves and the have-nots. And as Peter had alluded to earlier, I think the great thing about financial planners is they are a caring lot. They are people who will give and believe in servicing their clients first. And so the ideas and the passion about getting to educational issues are extremely abundant and high energy by our members. And FPA's biggest challenge is to how to cull the ones that are the best and that we can get behind on a consistent basis.
Well, everybody who comes into our office, every one of them, just almost to a person, says, I really don't know much about this. There's just a tremendous lack of knowledge about finances and money, and I don't know why we don't teach more about it in school, and it's along with relationships and some of the things that really count in life that we all need to deal with. And we're happy to serve them, and there's certainly a great need for it, but that educational effort needs to...
Well, I think some of our right now, a lot of our advocacy focus is on trying to get some clarity about the distinctions between financial planning and other financial services issues. But down the road, I do believe that you will see FPA taking bigger stances on public policy issues. We've hired new staff in Washington, D.C. to proactively address some of these issues And we need to build our advocacy efforts so that when we go to Washington, D.C. and sit down with the national legislators, we have a voice in saying, in the educational process in this country, beginning at the fourth grade level and taking it up from there, that there needs to be mandatory courses in financial literacy. And I think that's the way that we're going to address this issue, by getting some government funds behind it. Because let's face it, it's the health of our economy, our nation, and the world to some extent that depends on this effort of having people understand their relationship with money and the power and destructive forces that it can have as well.
Well, you mentioned the new FPA Political Action Committee, and I think that's something worth talking about for a minute, because what you just explained is that the PAC isn't just trying to further the interests of financial planners.
What we're trying to do with our Political Action Committee fund is we've got to open the doors. That's just the way life is in the political system. You have to open doors to make some progress, and I think one of the beauties of FPA is that decisions that we make here, that and this is in alignment with what we did with the broker-dealer rule and the lawsuit that we filed against the SEC, is that we were not only taking a position to serve our members, but we did so in alignment with our desires to serve the public. I mean, it wasn't a self-serving decision for us. It was something that we said we need to create a level playing field for people that are really providing advisory services. And then secondly, the public deserves the right to know what they're getting in terms of the type of advice or financial services relationship that they need to be getting.
Well,
if you want to go beyond that, I think other reasons to open the door and what this emerging profession of financial planning can do in the future is that things like Medicare, Social Security, tax issues, savings, the terrible savings rate we have in this country. These are the things that I think, one of the things with our new positions in D.C., we're really going to take a heightened awareness to say we have a voice in this, and it's time we make use of that voice in a very strong, proactive way. And part of that way is, again, through our political action efforts to raise funding so we can go tell our story to the folks that make the laws in this country. And besides that, open the doors to the regulatory agencies that have impact as well. So I think this is kind of the neat thing about FPA, that the prior organizations that serve financial planning were not as focused on. They were more focused on trying to serve their members' needs and getting their practices built and up and running. But FPA now is in a position to combine all the efforts of those old organizations and say, we're something a little bit more than a membership association. We are a voice, and that voice can serve in many ways, and I think we're starting to see that happen.
Let's talk about the first stance that the FPA has taken with their Political Action Committee. You mentioned the Merrill Lynch rule. I don't think our listeners have any idea what we're talking about there. In fact, I don't think anybody other than financial planners know the implications of this or that anything's been done. So let's start from scratch. Can you explain what the rules are and why there's a need for the FPA to sue the SEC?
Well, this goes back a lot of years to the Securities Acts of 1934 and 1940, which at the time were created to regulate and to some extent separate the actions of various types of financial services organizations. The rules were put in place that separated those that were in the business of transactions and providing specific advice about certain products from those who were calling themselves investment advisors. Their job was to work on behalf of the client and to provide advice to the client and not to be self-interest in a product solution.
For my own purposes, just I think listeners of this program should consider a couple of things. Number one is there are, this is something that I think just from a clarity standpoint to which Jim speaks to, is that you see a lot of TV commercials from major financial services firms that are expressing the capability of providing financial planning services. And while they may have the capability, is that you'll see oftentimes a disclaimer on those television ads that says basically you're not getting a financial planning relationship, you're getting a brokerage relationship. So these are things that we're trying to express to the government to say, if a major financial services firm wishes to provide financial planning advice, they should just simply step up and have their people registered as investment advisors and deliver financial planning. Why skirt the rule? And we're just saying, let's create a place where everybody lives equally here and nobody gets any special treatment. I think that's part of the deal, is that we're seeing just too many opportunities where consumers are being told one thing through a television ad, but, you know, actually when they get into a relationship, membership, it's something else, and that's just not fair to the consumer. And that's part of the reason why we want to create clarity through our lawsuit.
What's the significance of registering as an investment advisor?
Well, when you register as an investment advisor, you have a duty of loyalty and obligation to your client, putting their interests first. When you are a registered representative of a broker-dealer, or as might be more popular term, a broker, you have a duty of loyalty to your organization, to your broker-dealer. And your only duty to the client is to the fact of suitability. Based on your age and your income and your knowledge of investments, is this an appropriate investment for someone, again, of your age, your knowledge, and your income level? So it doesn't have anything to do with, let me make sure that I understand your entire situation, all the things that you're trying to accomplish here, and then saying, you know what, perhaps the best thing for you is not my investments, it's something else. Maybe you need to deal with an insurance issue first or a tax issue first. It really is the difference of having a duty to your client versus duty to your organization.
Well, that was well put. Choosing a financial planner is something that, even deciding whether to use a financial planner or not, is something that is could be a life-altering decision. And how do people know whether this financial planner is an investment advisor and therefore has to look out for their best interest, whether this financial planner isn't, whether this financial planner is a salesperson who's looking out for the best interest of the company, whether this financial planner even knows, frankly, even has a level of knowledge that's sufficient to be giving advice? How do people sift through all these professionals out there and determine who they should be working with?
Well, it's a great question, and hopefully I can give you some thoughts in direction on this. I mean, one of the things I think that FPA does very well is to provide a lot of information and education that's easily accessible on our website. We have a consumer website that allows consumers to download brochures and pamphlets that would allow them to prep themselves for a process that would allow them to find a qualified financial planner. These brochures kind of set up in a way where you hear the questions you need to become familiar with, what you need to ask, because the consumer or the individual seeking the financial planner is very responsible for making the decision in terms of the interview process and asking the right questions. It shouldn't be the first person that you look, see in the top of the list in the phone book, you know, AAA financial planning. They have to do something that says, you know, I'm going to interview five different financial planning firms. I'm going to kind of get a sense of the kind of services they provide. I want to understand how they would line up with my specific needs, how they are paid. And maybe there are specific issues that they might have from a conflict of interest standpoint. And the materials that we would provide from FPA, if you went to our website, would just really give you just a good sense of comfort that you're going to be able to ask all the right questions. And I think you really should interview at least three financial planning firms before you make a decision. After doing so, then you rely on just kind of the facts you've gathered, and you should trust your intuition that you interviewed was you feel was feeding you a line, or there was too much braggadocio or something like that, then that probably tells you something. Because, you know, when we give advice on investment scams, if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
Right.
And that's what we always say in terms of, you know, if you ever get some kind of statement that says that's too good to be true, it probably is. And I would say you need to pick up and move on. So, I mean, one of the things that we do for the consumer that, you know, visits our website, we have an ability to access a list of names of members who are certified financial planners that provide a lot of detail and background on their listings to say, you know, if I live in San Jose or, you know, someplace close to Silicon Valley, here's the kind of planning that I do, here's the kind of client that I serve. So you'll be able to go into interviews knowing a little bit about that planner, and then just, you know, again, it's an investigative process that the individual seeking financial planning has to lead and has to own. They have to own it. It's not something that you should leave it in the hands of the financial planning person to convince you that they're the right person. You have to come up with the final answer, and FPA has the tools that can help you get there.
And I also believe that I think referrals are a major portion of this. So seeking out from coworkers, family members, friends, of professionals that they've used is a good place to start, and educating our clients. So when people come in to see you and your practice, Peter and Jason, so that they're taking that message back out, telling their friends and associates about the good work that you do. Let's face it, you go to see a good movie or a good play or read a good book or have a great meal, you want to share that information, and it's just not something that's educated in in the consumer yet, that they should be sharing about the good experiences that they're having with their quality financial planning professional.
Well, you guys have mentioned the website a couple of times. We will put it in the show notes as well, but why don't you give our listeners the website where they can go and find these brochures, this information that the FPA publishes?
Okay. Well, the website address is www.fpanet.org, and the first, when you click on that, you'll see what we call a gateway page, which will offer you an ability to go to different sites, and there will be one site that basically is, you'll discern that it is a consumer site that will have all this information, brochures, articles. You even have an ability, if you have a question for a CFP professional, to ask that question, and our staff here in Denver will feed that to one of our members who have volunteered to ask questions, that you can get kind of a specific financial planning question answered. So there's a variety of tools that if you went there, but you'll also see websites that focus on our efforts to serve our members. So if you just wanted to take a look there, just to get a sense on the different types of things that we do for the folks that actually deliver financial planning services, that might be a helpful way to use the website. The third entry point is that we publish a magazine that's called the Journal of Financial Planning, that you'll be able to access the kind of information that we deliver to subscribers of that publication. The fourth one is, and you alluded to it earlier in the interview, is that FPA does have members in 43 countries, and we do have an international web page where we are trying to provide information to our members about how they can do a better job of providing services, what we call cross-border services. So if you happen to be a member, a United States citizen, and for some reason you're practicing in Canada and you have citizens of both countries, how you discern between the two different kinds of tax and compliance laws of those countries so you can best do your job there. And so we have a full-time effort in that respect too. So there's a wealth of information on our website, and there's four different ways you can access it. And, please, I'd encourage anybody that's listening to the program to make it your first stop as you think about educating yourself about financial planning. And if you are indeed in the mode to seek a financial planner, please go there and learn a little bit more about it before you make your decisions.
And aspiring financial planners, that's a good place to go as well.
Peter, I'm glad you raised that, because I think that's one of, our significant efforts is that over the short 35 years that we've been around, we're now finally to a position that people are coming out of college seeking for their first career to be financial planners. And it's one of our challenges as a profession is to create career paths and opportunities for individuals to latch on to, existing strong practices or to work with major financial services firms so they have a home to practice their art and science of financial planning, but this profession can continue to emerge and blossom.
Well, that also overlaps with the FPA's efforts to try to inculcate a standard that people can rely on, kind of an initial screen, if you will, the CFP mark, which also is being picked up in, I think, 18 other countries. And people can look for financial planning groups in their own countries, like FPA Australia and Malaysia. And, there are other things out there, too. But, again, the website is www.fpanet.org. And why don't you give us a quick rundown? There's so much to talk about, but what the Certified Financial Planner mark is about and how the FPA holds that.
Well, the CFP mark is, I would call that the symbol of professional excellence in financial planning. There are approximately 48,500 people in the United States that hold that, and actually a similar number, probably even a little bit more in those 18 countries that you speak of, Peter. So there's about 100,000 worldwide now. And the CFP, demonstrates a technical competence by examination, a very rigorous examination that is 10 hours over 2 days, very similar to the CPA exam. They have to show, I think it's 3 years of experience prior to receiving the CFP. They commit to ongoing continuing education, and that they have to show to the regulatory body for CFPs, which is called the CFP Board of Standards. The CFP is unique in terms of those folks who profess to practice financial planning, is that the CFP voluntarily subscribes to be regulated, and it's private regulation, but the way that it's done is that a CFP knows that if there is some type of infraction that requires the removal of the CFP mark, they voluntarily have given that right to the CFP Board of Standards to do so. And the CFP Board also is responsible for the examination and the ethics requirements. And, you know, FPA, as the professional association, concurrently has an ethics process that mirrors the CFP Board of Standards. We believe in the CFP Code of Ethics and professional responsibility, and that's a requirement for membership in FPA.
And the CFP coursework covers a number of different areas that really include the major subtopics within financial planning: investments, insurance, employee benefits,
estate
retirement,
planning.
Estate planning, all the major areas there. So it's a well-rounded person who's been through all that training.
And the CFP mark, just to educate our listeners, the Financial Planning Association is, for lack of a better term, sort of the sponsor of the CFP mark in the United States, but the CFP mark does not come from the Financial Planning Association.
That is correct. The CFP mark is granted through the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, who regulates the mark, and their mission is to serve the public by providing quality and ethical access to financial planners who have earned a designation. FPA's mission is to advance the financial planning profession and the knowledge base of financial planning. So we actually become the home for the certified financial planner, as well as other professionals that have an interest in the delivery and support of financial planning. So that could be the CPA, it could be the attorney that either practices estate planning or business succession planning, things of that nature. The insurance professional who may have the CLU or the CHFC designation, all of these various professionals have their home inside of the Financial Planning Association, because we believe that those areas of specialization add to the richness of the delivery of the financial planning experience for the client.
And the FPA is, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I think we're trying to promote financial planning as a credible and useful service, and therefore having a standard designation that we all get behind helps clarify the muddy waters, because the consumer has a heck of a time sorting through it. We were with a potential client last week and trying to explain to their board the differences between the different kinds of financial planners out there, and I think we spent half the meeting just talking about that background before we got to our own particular areas of expertise. It's pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah, what the CFP brings to the table is a multidisciplined approach to looking at the entire game plan of an individual. And I think that's one of the things that I've learned in my years here at FPA, that, I mean, what we need to do better here is to really emphasize the ability to use financial planning techniques and tools to better align the individual with meeting what they have on their list of goals and objectives from a life standpoint. And we've got to do a better job of that, because too many individuals live disconnected in a way that the kind of the financial picture side doesn't really match up with the life goals side. And I think that's what the intent of the financial planning process is, to do that. And, you know, regardless if, you know, you're affluent or find yourself being one of those folks in the middle class, I mean, I think the process is the beauty of financial planning, that allows you to look comprehensively at your life and set up a game plan that for you to meet those life goals that you have, whether it's choosing a different vocation or getting your kids through college or just being able to retire comfortably. So I think it's a very very important thing that has been established over these past 35 to 40 years, and part of our job at FPA is to get that message out loud and clear that it's something that everybody needs to do.
Yeah, and the other aspect about the CFP designation, I think it's important for your listeners to know, is it is the only designation that comes from a pure financial planning background. All the other designations out there come from one of the subsets, either from the investment side, the tax side, the insurance side, or the legal side. So the pureness of the CFP mark is the fact that it is all financial planning based and doesn't have this strength. Now, the beauty of the FPA is that it says those other designations and expertise is valuable and a very important part of making sure that that process is the best it can be for the end user, the client. And by our motto of being an inclusive organization, we try to promote those beautiful qualities, that beautiful mixture of the special background that the CFP has with the specialization of other areas allows for that beautiful mixture to come to life.
I think you're really talking about financial planning as, again, inclusive and what we like to say here, sort of a holistic approach where you're looking at the multiple disciplines and making them work together to support, as you mentioned, the life goals of the people. And this seems to me that it's something that's relatively new movement. I know, as you said previously, people had stockbrokers and you know, the idea was to kind of make as much money as you can and what's the best stock for me. But financial planning is a lot more than that. Financial planning is trying to align your finances with your what you want to do with your life, or trying to make your finances support what you want to do with your life. How do you see the financial planning changing over the years? And since it's such a new profession, where do you see it headed?
Well, again, we talked about how young financial planning is, so there is a continuing evolution. And I think some of the things that you're alluding to about life planning and other names is just that financial planning is continuing to get better. And the leading professionals are examining the fact that they can be better, the process can be better, and the value of the benefit of this all comes out to a better experience for their clients. And we referred back to the fact that financial planners are very much about their clients. So they work on trying to get this better and better. And I think we'll continue to see over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years that the process of financial planning will continue to evolve to a point where it will be such a valuable experience, such a pleasant experience, that people will grow up saying, you know, it's customary that, you know, just like I have a doctor, I have a general practitioner or an internist, I have a financial planner. If I move to a new town, one of the first things I do is, either if I can't stay with my existing financial planner, I seek a new one. I think what we will also see is that financial planning will be recognized from a legislative standpoint and a regulatory standpoint as its own distinct practice, and not a part of a subset of the other financial service delivery models. And the beauty of this will mean that those that practice financial planning will have a consistent, simplified regulatory system to work under that will recognize that regardless of how they are being compensated, that the important aspect is the process that they follow, putting their clients' interests first, full disclosure, and competency. When you put those things together and that can be regulated that way, then what we will see 15, 20 years down the road is that there won't be that confusion in the marketplace. People won't need to know the difference between a financial planner and some other financial service professional. Matter of fact, the CFP designation may not even be important anymore from the standpoint of it would be a clearly identified profession of financial planning regulated and legislated so that those that would call themselves financial planners couldn't do so unless they met the ethical standards, the competency standards, the educational standards, and the experience standards.
And I might add that that's a great wrap-up, and that this is really a worldwide movement. It's not just in the U.S., but there may be international standards, and it may become understood not only broadly in the U.S., but in other countries as well. I think the people who listen to this podcast of ours, this show, are already doing a lot to educate themselves. I'm glad that they had a chance to get to hear about the FPA because it's an important organization. You guys are doing a fantastic job. And the more they know, the better a job they can do in selecting and working with a financial planner as well when they eventually get one. I do think that almost anybody could benefit from having a financial planner. There's just so much to know. And when they look for qualifications, the education and the designations and the experience and so on, two more that I would add would be look for someone who has a passion for what they do and that cares about you. With those two qualities, I think the rest falls into line. So visit the fpanet.org website, whether you're a consumer, you're interested in becoming a financial planner, or if you have a need for triage and emergency help, the fpareliefcenter.org website is there. Can anybody at all contact the relief workers or the people who are available for advice, or do you have to be directly affected by a disaster?
Well, the way we have positioned it now, I mean, some of our chapters may have different specific efforts that are focused on their particular areas, but for FPA, generally, our focus is right now on 9/11, Katrina, and supporting our military that are overseas and have taken a major financial hit in doing so. So those are our major efforts right now. And but I mean, certainly, if there's any questions in terms of how they might seek support, I would not hesitate to send us an email to FPA, and we'll do our very best to find a connection for you.
Oh, thank goodness for the internet. Most people can get there. Is there a phone number too that we can give people who don't necessarily have?
800-322-4237 and hit 0 to be connected to one of our member services coordinators.
Great. Well, Marvin, Jim, thank you very much for being on our show, and I think it was very educational for our listeners.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It was our pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview today. Thanks to all our listeners. And please make sure to visit our website at www.promoneytalk.com. And feel free to send us questions if you'd like by clicking on the link on the website and contacting us, or going to
promoneytalk@google.com. We've been getting some good questions from our listeners. And when we think that it's appropriate, we'll share them with you if they're of broad or general interest.
Thank you for listening. Until next week, here's to your success.